Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks for joining me, and welcome. I recently spoke with Kim Tallbear about her new book, Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging and the False Promise of Genetic Science. This came out in 2013 with the University of Minnesota Press. This book is a really wonderfully transdisciplinary story that brings together STS, Indigenous and Native American studies, histories of science and race, ethnographies of science, of race, and of other kinds of communities, both in person and online, and cultural studies. What she's doing here is she's tracing what she calls a genealogy of Native American DNA as a tool, as an object, and as a notion. And along the way, what she does is she brings together really careful studies of communities who are consuming genetic genealogy, tribe members and people who are organizing tribal communities and looking for ways to think through strategies of enrollment, questions of who gets to count as a member of a tribe and who doesn't. And she also looks at marketing and sort of strategies for producing DNA profiles as a product, but also, you know, as a product that's not just something to consume, but that's something that's really shaping broader notions of identity on many levels. One of the things I really love about the book, too, is that it's not just a series of critiques, but it really does present some concrete ideas at the end of the day for how we might, moving forward, create a more productive relationship between technoscience, sort of ideas of identity and Native peoples and their engagement with these projects and products. And so it's really fascinating. It was great to talk with Kim about it. And I especially recommend listening to the end, because at the end of the story, she also talks about an equally fascinating new project that she's working on that I think will definitely be of interest to anybody who's interested in this book itself. Thanks for listening. I'm here today to talk with Kim Tallbear about her new book, Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging and the False Promise of Genetic Science. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Kim, and thanks very, very much for making the time to talk with me today. I loved the book, and I'm really, really looking forward to talking with you about it.
Thanks for having me.
So the book that we're here to talk about both transcends academic discipline and represents a bringing together of the tools of several academic disciplines at the same time. And these include, but aren't limited to, STS or science studies, Native American and Indigenous studies, and cultural studies, among others. So since we're talking for the purposes of new books in STS, let's start by focusing on that aspect of things. So can you talk a little bit about what brought you to this particular field? How did you come to start working on STS as one aspect of the constellation of fields that you work in?
Well, the answer to that is a little bit circuitous, and that I have to go into why I came to graduate school to write a dissertation on this topic in the first place.
Sure.
I had never heard of STS as a field. I wish that I had. I might have found my way to it much sooner, but I was working for an Indigenous organization, a national tribal organization in Denver. I had been working in private consulting. I had also worked for the Environmental Protection Agency, and on this one particular project, I was contracting to the Department of Energy, working on tribal government stakes in the cleanup of the nuclear weapons complex. And so at that time, we were doing a lot of work with tribes in the Pacific Northwest, and I was spending a lot of time at Department of Energy meetings, and they happened to be funding the mapping of the human genome at that time. They no longer do this kind of funding. But so we put in a grant, my organization, to look at the implications for Indigenous peoples of the mapping of the human genome. And I immediately became really fascinated with this. I had already had an interest in the intersections of tribal governance, culture, and then issues of science and technology, and the way that science and technology can be used both to impinge upon Native American sovereignty, but the ways in which it can also be used to shore that up or to expand sovereignty and governance. Now, so I'm a perfect fit for STS, right? But I did not know this field existed. I was trained as a planner, an environmental and community planner. So I started looking around for graduate programs in order to really participate in that project and the implications for Indigenous peoples of the mapping of the human genome. I had to go back to graduate school. I knew that. I was not equipped to really participate in that conversation in a meaningful way. And I knew that I wanted to write my dissertation on something related to research on Native American bodies. because we also spend a lot of time in Native communities arguing amongst ourselves and with others about the balance between culture, biology, and politics and making us who we are. And so I knew that understanding the biology or the genetics was a piece of being able to weigh in on that conversation. Looked around for graduate schools, did not really know what I was doing, but I found my way to Jim Clifford and Donna Haraway at the History of Consciousness program at UC Santa Cruz because I was a little familiar with Jim's work already. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I did not know who Donna Haraway was. And they both accepted me as joint advisors. And it's very clear to me now that was a perfect fit for me, and found my way to feminist science studies through my work with Donna.
That's great. So you came to graduate school in the first place knowing that you wanted to work on some aspect of this topic then?
Yes, I did.
So the topic did start out as a dissertation, and there was undoubtedly at least some sort of transformation between dissertation to book. So can you talk a little bit then about that aspect of the project? How did you ultimately decide to craft this particular book that looks this particular way as an object out of the dissertation? And were there any kinds of transformations or changes along the way from one medium to the other in the way that you were thinking about conceptualizing or positioning the project?
You know, I actually went to graduate school to write a book. I mean, I'm a very pragmatic person. I actually had no intention of staying in the academy. I thought I would come in, write a dissertation that would be an embryonic form of the book, come back out and quickly get it out. But I ended up staying in the academy because I realized actually I'm a better academic perhaps than I was a planner. Although my work as a planner and training as a planner really informed the kind of academic that I am. So I finished the dissertation quickly. I finished in a little over 4 years. But the field work was also part of the consulting work I had done. I always meshed my contract work and planning work with field work with academic writing. And so I'm probably a hybrid type of researcher that way. I probably finished a little too quickly. I had a child. I wanted to get out and get down to doing things. And so it took a little bit longer to get the book done. It wasn't published until 2013. But during that time, what I was able to do was really, I think, produce a much more engaged conclusion that's focused more on policy interventions, educational interventions. I was able to further my networking among STS people, among science policy people, funders, indigenous genome scientists, other kinds of scientists. And so that conclusion is probably a reflection of the particular way that I do academic work, which is deeply informed by my experience as a community planner.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear you say that, because one of the things that really struck me about the conclusion was how impressive it was in terms of it wasn't simply rehashing what you had already done in the book, right? I mean, a lot of conclusions feel sort of slapped on at the end, and I don't mean that necessarily as a bad thing, but do that kind of work. And this conclusion was really doing very productive, forward-moving work that added something very substantive to the study. And so it's interesting to hear that.
And I'm indebted to all of the people that I networked with, that I work with, who are my colleagues, who cross disciplines, who cross agencies and institutions in Indian country, out in genome research institutes. I have been given so much opportunity to advise people, to participate in conversations. And so my learning about how to move forward, I mean, most of the book is a critique, right? It's a historical critique, it's an anthropological critique, it's an STS critique. I weigh in on Native governance issues and the potential assault on Indigenous sovereignty by genome research. But being a planner, and my mother was a planner, and I come out of a community where there was a lot of American Indian Movement activism, I don't just want to sit with the problem. That's the first step. The next step is, where do we go from here? And that conclusion is a reflection of all of the conversations and collaborative work I was able to do with people to think that through, because you can't, as an individual, have a vision for what to do next. You need to be in conversation with many different stakeholders in this game.
And because this is something that actually explicitly comes up in the book, and it was something that I had in mind to ask you about a little bit later, but since it's already come up, let's talk about it a little now. You've mentioned explicitly, again, both in the book and then just now in the course of our early conversation, that you did have training as a planner before you came to the project. And you've just been talking a little bit about the fact that your training as a planner did inform your work in the book, were there any specific ways that you can think of that the nature of the argument that you were making in the book was informed directly or in a way that really strikes you as important by your work as a planner and by your experience as a planner?
Yes, and I think I go into this in the conclusion, in the introduction. My, as I said, I was raised the daughter of a tribal and community planner. My mother doesn't have any degrees, but she was doing a lot of grant writing and organizing in the days of the American Indian Movement. And what a lot of people don't know about that is they weren't just out protesting, which is one important thing to do, but they were actually doing a lot of institution building. And I grew up between the reservations in eastern South Dakota and the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And in the Twin Cities, there were American Indian Movement survival schools. There was the first American Indian low-income housing project in the country. And my mom was part of the group of people who were getting those institutions going in the 1970s. And so I grew up in this with this idea that research is for change. So I was exposed to research from early on because my mother is a grant writer and a community organizer had to do a lot of research, and they were always engaging with the federal funding agencies and different kinds of planning organizations. And so it made sense to me. I had, however, no exposure in my family or my extended community to anything to do with academic research and didn't really understand that. Then I became a planner, got a bachelor's degree in community planning from UMass Boston. I went to MIT and did a master's in city planning, focused on environmental policy, and then went out to work, as I said, with tribes and federal agencies, and carried that ethos with me that research is always for change. And so when I came into the academy, into a very cultural studies oriented program, in which I think in a less applied way, cultural studies people, at least my cohort at History of Consciousness, did think about making change in the world for sure. But it wasn't always the kinds of hands-on social change in these very applied institution building ways that I had grown up with. And so I felt a little uncomfortable. Also, as I sort of moved into anthropological literature and my field research was supposed to be informed in many ways by doing ethnography, I was a little uncomfortable with going into a community, particularly an indigenous community, handing over an informed consent form, treating the people I was interviewing or doing participant observation with as this sort of well of cultural knowledge that I would draw upon, and then I would go out and produce my own discrete dissertation or publications. That is not the way that I saw research playing out for most of my life. And so I had to really navigate that. And as such, I spend a lot of time as well talking about how I thought through those ethics and those practices. And I'm at a point where I'm pretty comfortable with that now, but I do spend a lot of time in that introduction going through the angst that I had and how I made my way through that.
Right. And it actually is, I think it works really well in the introduction as part of the larger set of issues that you set out here that inform how you describe your practice as an academic and the ways that it engages some of the key concepts and key orientations that come from, at least in part, STS as a field. So the kind of move that you're making in the introduction, and you talk about these issues, at least in part, in terms of Native Americans being, quote, less subjects of this book than a key part of its audience. The writing style very much engages your voice as a participant and as an author, as a narrator, very explicitly. And these all, at least for me, from the perspective of one reader, right, really interestingly intersect with some of these larger concepts that you're talking about engaging in this part of the book, including feminist epistemologies and standpoints and situated knowledges, including the themes of co-production and articulation. So what of these many themes that constellate around the issues that you're talking about in this early part of the book, what have been some of the most important touchstones for you from STS that have shaped the argument that you're making here?
Well, I think, too, probably that a lot of other people draw upon. And because I was a Donna Haraway student and I didn't know STS existed before I met Donna, I'm very much influenced by the feminist strand of science and technology studies. I think of it as a left coast California type of STS. I don't know what it looks like anywhere else. I mean, I get these little hints of it, but my world is feminist STS in California. And so that is one and that intersected well with the way that I grew up. When I came to read Donna and Sandra Harding and other people that she assigned, I came to understand very quickly what something like situated knowledge is or standpoint theory is, because I had already grown up with those sort of core ideas, although in a different language. I inherited that from my mother. My mother, when I was a child, always emphasized that Dakota people should be telling our own stories from out of our own lives, that it's not that we should dismiss the histories written by white, usually heterosexual males, you know, of our people and our history, that we should not completely dismiss that, but we would all should always read that with a critical eye, and we should inform the contemporary telling of our history with our own oral histories. I was taught in my community that oral histories are legitimate ways of knowing. So we had these very sophisticated conversations in my house amongst an extended family, none of whom had college degrees, that resonated very well with situated knowledge and standpoint. So when I got access to the theoretical language in graduate school, I understood it very quickly. The ideas made sense. And I'm really grateful for the theoretical languages that I inherited from my advisors to help me put a different kind of language to some core ideas that I already in large part felt like I understood or could engage with. And then the other thing, of course, Donna was very clear that I needed to engage with the work of Sheila Jasanoff and other people who are using the co-production idiom. And that, of course, has been very fruitful to me and really helped me to understand this complex interplay, right, between molecules, between the DNA markers that get labeled as Native American DNA, the practices that happen in laboratories and in scientific conversations, and how those are both informed by histories of 19th century federal Indian policy, histories of the articulation of race in the Americas. And those are things I was already delving into through another body of literature. I'd already worked in federal Indian policy. I'd grown up between reservations and urban Indian communities. So I understood in very complex ways what Sheila Jasanoff would call a social order. And then I was able in my field works to engage more with the science. And so the co-production idiom really gave me, again, a really nice, complex, but coherent language to describe what I saw going on out in the world. And I really am grateful. I'm grateful for that idiom. Many of us work with that, right? It helps us make sense of the really complex interplay of the social and the quote unquote natural.
Great. And this brings us actually really nicely into the very rich, very detailed empirical work that these concepts help you explore and that and through which your work explores these concepts. And so this brings us into the first chapter. The first chapter looks, among other things, at the ways that concepts of race and of tribe organize Native American identity or identities in different ways that sometimes overlap. And this chapter really brings together a history, a historical account of race science in the 19th and early 20th centuries with a consideration of the ways that this lays a foundation for looking at the genealogy of the production of Native American DNA as a techno-scientific object. So one of the things that you're exploring in this chapter is the emergence of DNA testing or DNA tests that are used in various ways and by various agents to trace Native American lineages and identities. So let's start right there, I think, to explore that. What are some of the main kinds of DNA tests that are used in this way, and what do listeners need to know about this? That's perhaps some of the most important points to understand how this is going to motivate the argument to come.
Right. So when I came back into the academy to write this dissertation, I was really focused on the use of DNA testing in tribal enrollment. But it wasn't, this was back in 2001, and it really was not happening in a widespread way back then. So I then got interested in and distracted by the research that was happening on Native American migrations. And of course, that research is really important. Human genome diversity research, of course, is very important because that informs the kinds of DNA analyses that get sold as tests by particular companies. And many of those companies have, of course, close alliances with academic scientists. So But it was interesting coming in at a moment when DNA tests weren't really being used in a widespread way. And by now, they are used in a widespread way by tribal governments, but not genetic ancestry testing. So there's a disconnect between what the public is buying. So people who are interested in finding a Native American in their family tree, they're purchasing genetic ancestry tests. So tests that look at the mitochondrial DNA or the maternal lineages, tests that look at Y chromosome or paternal lineages. You've got autosomal tests that are looking at sets of markers across the genome, and that those are the tests that provide the sort of percentage of ancestry on particular continent type tests that have been heavily critiqued as having these longstanding continental racial notions at the heart of how those tests are developed. And so those are the three main ones, right? But when you jump to tribes and the kinds of DNA tests they increasingly used throughout the first decade after 2000, those are DNA parentage tests, the DNA profile or forensic DNA, very different. And all those tests do that tribes are looking at is show that your biological parent is your biological parent. And because tribes in doing enrollment or citizenship, all they want to do is document that an enrollment applicant is the biological offspring of somebody who is already on the tribal rolls or eligible to be on the tribal rolls. And of course, genetic ancestry testing that is locating your ancestry or part of your ancestry on a particular continent and locating you to unnamed individuals in a founding population, that's not useful for tribes. So I had to learn about both. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely. It sets the stage for us to the conversation. I'm sure we'll go into more detail about some of these tests in particular later on in the chapters. But as we kind of set the stage, because you open the book up with this in the first chapter, I just wanted to kind of lay the foundation. One of the things that I noticed about the way you were bringing this up that really impressed me is that you're really thoughtful about giving a basic primer on the science of DNA for your readers. And the importance of giving this kind of background is also something that comes up later in the book. And it seems to be an important argumentative move and also an important move that you're making as a scholar. I mean, you're deciding to integrate this into the book. Can you talk about that a little bit? And in what ways is it important for you to give this kind of scientific background detail to your readers? And why is that important for the larger work that you're doing with the book and with the project?
Well, I would hope anybody, I mean, I'm making a pretty complicated social and political argument about why DNA is not going to solve our messiest political problems having to do with Native American DNA. And we can't figure out, one cannot understand my argument unless one understands basically what the genetics is about. One of the things that I argue constantly wherever I am, whether I'm in tribal communities or whether I'm in scientific communities or humanities communities, is that there are two sets of complicated knowledges at play here, and almost nobody has a handle on both sets. There is the incredibly complex world of tribal law, federal Indian policy, and tribal enrollment politics, and there is the incredibly complex world of human genome diversity research and other forms of genetic knowledge production. And what I have actually found, for example, when I'm talking to reporters, is that they have an easier time getting their head around the basics of the science than they do getting their head around the basics of the politics of Native American tribal enrollment. And the problem is we've got scientists advising tribes who do not understand the histories of those politics. They absolutely do not understand it. And it is clear in the language that they use. And you've got tribal people, even people, tribal enrollment directors who are using DNA profiles who do not understand what they're using. They sometimes themselves conflate the DNA tests they are using, the parentage tests, with genetic ancestry tests. And this is a problem. And so that's what I want to call attention to. We need people out there who are at least somewhat bilingual in these two forms of knowledge. And I, in part, also, I think, put that in the book because I need to remind myself, I by no means am able to keep up with what's going on in Native American DNA research. It's really complicated. I remember when I took my first genetics class at UC Santa Cruz, I was fascinated. And the thing I remember, the main thing that overwhelmed me was the visuals of the DNA double helix. It seemed so infinite. I literally, like higher forms of mathematics, I could not wrap my head around its infinity. It was so big and so complex. And so there's a way in which I constantly have to revisit the basic science because it's just really hard to keep your mind around it, you know, but in terms of the Native American enrollment politics and histories of federal Indian policy, well, we in Indian country engage with that every day. We are always talking about these politics. We're bombarded with it. We bombard each other with it every day. And so, you know, I don't do that with genetics as much. So I guess it was both for my own, to keep my own head where it needed to be in writing this book, but it's also to demonstrate for other people that you can't think you can weigh in on this conversation without having a grasp of multiple kinds of knowledges.
That's right. And it really practices one of many major themes that I at least got out of the book as one reader, which is the co-production of the science and the politics or the culture, right? They co-produce each other. And so that works really nicely to have that in the book.
Because right. And the state people involved in the conversation can't see that if they only have a whole bunch of knowledge about one set of issues and none about the other.
That's right. Now, another kind of work that this chapter in particular is doing is to try to argue against a tendency to conflate genetic concepts with blood concepts of identity in larger discourses of racial and tribal identification, and the ways that these, what we identify usually as biology, informs those. And so the chapter compares dominant U.S. concepts of blood with Native American or tribal blood concepts and talks about the importance of blood to tribal enrollment in particular. So can you speak a little bit to that? What do listeners need to know about the importance of blood to tribal enrollment right now to understand the ways that this gets conflated with and engaged with genetic concepts of tribal enrollment?
Right. You know, I think most of the country has moved on from blood talk to gene talk. And I've really noticed that since the mid-1990s. I mean, even in popular films, right, you back in the mid-1990s and before, you know, vampires were caused by, or even zombies or any of these monsters, there was evil involved. The church was more involved. The priest held sway. And blood was still in part being looked at as this physiological thing that inhered properties in it. And then you move into contemporary popular discourse, and that's why I refer to films, because it's popular and it's in the air. Everything is caused by a virus now. Vampirism, zombie stuff is caused by a virus, and we no longer have priests holding sway, but scientists are holding sway. They are the high priests who can solve our problems and do the exorcisms of the virus out of our bodies. So there is this way, I think, in which the dominant U.S. culture has moved on, but tribes have not moved on. We are still very much involved in the language of blood. Now, the mistake, I think, that gets made by people on the outside, and even by, I think, some Native American and Indigenous studies scholars, is to assume that when Native people are speaking about blood, that they're always thinking about blood, the physiological substance, as having these biological properties that therefore determine or in this deterministic way make a Native American. And so I think there is too strong of a hand used sometimes to critique Native American communities for what scholars would call their biological essentialism when they're talking about blood. Blood is very symbolic in our communities as well. And so when scholars or critics say, well, they're talking about blood quantum and blood is being important to determining Native American identity, that's why we can't, you know, there's a lot of critique of tribes using blood quantum or blood lineage in enrollment. There's the suggestion that tribes should move simply to cultural affiliation and administer some sort of cultural test, or they should just have citizenship and naturalize people in the way that the United States might, and we should eschew all notions of blood, or at least have them counterbalanced by these other things. I argue that, and then they'll move in the next sentence to saying, see, they're genetically fetishistic. And one of the things that I want to make clear is that if we conflate genetics in the blood talk of Native Americans living today or the blood talk of Native Americans or other people living in the past, and that's often what happens, somebody will refer to the blood talk that has spanned the 20th century and call that genetic fetishism. But tribal people and many other people did not understand biology in the form of genes at that time. Genetics is not a timeless language. Genes are not timeless concepts. The DNA double helix in the form that we have apprehended it, that happened in 1953. So this is why I call attention to, let's be very particular when we're looking at blood talk and the way people speak about blood. When in history were they speaking? Let's dig down and figure out what they might actually mean. And I think much of the time, there's not this direct genetic or biologically essentialist meaning that should be taken from that kind of talk. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So as we move from this to the next chapter of the book, we move into a close look at the technical and also cultural production of six DNA testing companies. And you focus on the six companies in particular that you say have targeted Native American ancestry and identity. So you talk about the emergence of a new science of molecular anthropology in the early 1960s and trace the way that some of these companies more recently have engaged with and helped produce or attempted to produce notions of Native American identity, but also notions of tribe specifically. So can you speak to this last issue? In what way are DNA testing companies targeting, producing, and complicating or perhaps not complicating notions of tribe and tribal identity? And why is that important for the argument that you're making here?
Well, you know, I think the DNA testing companies overlap with the practices and assumptions of what's happening in academic science as well. And in that chapter, so much changes in this industry so quickly, half of those companies are out of business now. Some of them have actually changed their advertising techniques. So things have moved along a bit. But I still think in basic terms, the visual representations and the language that I analyze and critique in that chapter is still very much present in this industry. But it's not just the industry, it's also within academic science. And so your question is about the race versus tribe concept and how they're using those two concepts.
Yeah.
So there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the way that Native Americans deploy the category of tribe versus the way that scientists who sometimes use that category understand it. And both tribe and race as categories in scientific papers and language are not evenly defined across the field. They are not usually very precisely defined. There's a real problem with the vagueness of the language that gets used and the way that different scientists use different tribal, national, racial terminologies and the way they deploy those categories in their science. So that unevenness across the field is actually, I think, kind of a problem. But that unevenness and the way that different scientists and different companies deploy concepts such as tribe, race, or nation are reflective, I think, of long histories of debate about what constitutes a racial category or not. And racial categories and divisions have changed over time, and they change over geography. Not every nation state has a similar racial category terrain, right? Things work really differently in the United States, for example, than they might work down in Brazil. And so there's all this messiness involved in the way those categories work. But I will say that in general in the United States, the way that race gets defined is very much informed by the histories of immigration, whether forced or chosen to this country. And so you have a lot of people who are buying tests, and a lot of the scientists who are doing genome research are people who are coming very much out of a broader historical narrative that focuses on immigration to the Americas. Well, Native Americans, to us, this is the center of the universe. We are not influenced by this dominant narrative of immigration. So right there, you've got a disconnect between the way that race might get deployed. So you've got in the scientific community and in the industry, people saying, well, let's look back to Africa, let's look to Europe, you know, let's look to Asia for these dominant streams of immigration. And that's the way that race gets categorized. It's the way that we do it in the United States. So that's the first problem, right? You've got these longstanding notions of race that continue to inform the way that people sample, the kinds of visual representations they use in company literature, the kinds of communities or customers that they're targeting who are organizing their identities according to these dominant racial categories, either one or more. And then you've got Native American notions of tribe. And when companies do take up the notion of tribe, they take it up. Well, let me step back a moment. It's not the companies that take it up first. It's the researchers that take it up. Because if you know anything about the science, you can't delineate tribe according to genetic markers. But I think precisely because scientists are using the category tribe in a different way that Native Americans use it, I often see language in the industry to the effect that, well, once we get a large enough data set, once we have sampled enough people, we may be able to find markers that are related to specific tribes. That is to fundamentally misunderstand the last 200 years of the colonial movement and management of Native Americans. Nobody stayed in the same place. Our ancestors did not stay in the same place post-contact. They were not allowed to because of colonization. And they certainly didn't stay in the same place pre-contact. People moved around. You know, they were human beings with agency and ideas. And, you know, there's too much of this imposition of a deanimation of Native Americans, I think, historically, that assumes they all stayed in the same place. They didn't have agency. They didn't move around. It's kind of like equating us with animals. And in fact, animals don't even do that, right? So anyway, there's this kind of history that informs the way that a scientist might define tribe. And as I've already alluded, for us, a tribe is a complex entity that's biological, cultural, social, political, and informed by the idea that we have moved around a lot post-contact and not always of our own will. And our tribes have dispersed. They've been reconfigured into different kinds of tribal entities. So to say you can just go sample some population that was supposedly in the same place for the last 500 years and get enough data to eventually find markers that you can link to one tribe or another is to have no understanding of 18th, 19th, and 20th century history. I hope that wasn't too...
No, that was great.
And too impenetrable.
That was great. And in fact, one of the reasons why this is so important, as you show in the chapter, is that there are real implications to this that are very practical that pertain to tribal enrollment, right? To rules for tribal enrollment, right. The way tribal enrollment is defined, the way it's regulated. And you talk about your own experience in this chapter as a participant observer at a national tribal enrollment conference and the ways that these issues played out among the different constituencies that were at this conference with you. That's one community that's engaging these ideas, and one practical, very, very practical implication, or a very practical space where the implications of this way of defining or perhaps, you know, erroneously construing the genetic determinants of tribe plays out. As you move to the next chapter, you look at another community, a different community, that also is wrestling with the ways that identity, tribal identity or broader Native American identity or white identity or other forms of identity are also imbricated with, are produced by and are producing notions of genetic identity. And this is a chapter that looks at practices of genetic genealogy. Now, you mentioned here that genealogy research has become a popular U.S. American pastime, and the way that you look at phenomena emerging from this in this chapter is by participant observation of an online community of DNA test consumers in the mid-2000s. So you consider in this chapter some questions as a way to understand the relationship of the members of this online community to genetic genealogy as a tool. So you kind of shift our focus a little bit. How do they characterize and understand DNA markers and molecules? How do genes for them relate to concepts of race, tribe, and nation? One of the concepts that comes up here creates a link to and further develops a notion that's also central earlier in the book, and this is a notion of gene fetishism. So you talk about this earlier on, but this is one of the questions that you bring to understanding this community, so I thought maybe we could talk about it in the context of this chapter. What is gene fetishism, and how does understanding what this is and looking for it help open up some of your observations of what's happening in this particular community of online participants, and how is this central to what you're arguing at this point of the book?
Well, so the way that I take gene fetishism is, in very basic terms, thinking about the gene as quote unquote the fundamental unit of life, and using the gene to stand in for what are really very complex, right, biological and environmental and social interactions. And so I try to render that in a more accessible language, but I took a lot of grief for using that term because I was in a talk I gave at Stanford back around 2005, cited that term, cited Donna Haraway. And, you know, Donna speaks in a way that's a little bit more artful than the way that I speak about these things. And so her language, first of all, was a big turnoff to people in that community, as is most academic language. And that's, I talk about that a lot in that chapter. But, you know, basically I was arguing in that community and with people. I wasn't just going away and speaking and writing about it elsewhere. I was having these extensive conversations with people online because I was a member of that listserv, that what they were doing was gene fetishism. They were using the gene or genetic markers to stand in for what are really much more complex social phenomenon. So if they were looking for a gene to give them some insight into Native American identity or ancestry, and they knew scientifically it's more complicated, right? They knew the science really well, but there was still a sense in which they wanted to privilege genes and markers over other kinds of and forms of knowledge. And, you know, I had a really hard time getting across the fact that yes, tribes do have the right to determine who belongs, and no, we don't have to go by genetic markers. That in fact, us doing citizenship in a more political way, us caring about cultural affiliation and actually being socialized in a Native community, this is not invalid. I mean, it's a different kind of knowledge, but gene fetishism is really, you know, using the gene or markers to stand in for, and maybe even take the place of a much more complex social reality. You know, and again, our social reality in tribes, it's not that we say biology doesn't matter. I mean, we care about biological descent, but that gets combined with political and social practice.
What were the most surprising aspects of that part of the research for you? What most surprised you about your engagement with that community?
Well, let's see. I actually really enjoyed it and I learned a lot. I guess one of a couple of the main things, and this took me years to process. I actually, in that chapter, I read that what was going on with white subjectivity, the subjectivity of self-identified white, largely middle-class or upper-middle-class, fairly well-educated people. It's a very particular demographic that was on that listserv. I read their subjectivity as white people against the subjectivity of the white people that my colleague Circe Sturm writes about in her book that deals with Becoming Indian, I think it's called, and all of these maybe 300 or more groups across the South that are starting nonprofits and calling themselves Cherokee tribes, and their subjectivity as white people, and reading that book really helped me understand what was going on the listserv, because they are, her informants are reacting in a very negative way against a white identity. They feel like it's vacuous, it's cultureless. They want to find a Native American identity. They have a malaise about the sort of where we are in the 21st century. Whereas my group on the genetic genealogy listserv, these are people who largely benefit from the privileges of whiteness. They are highly educated. They have money. They have a lot of scientific knowledge. They are not looking, even as they look for Native American ancestry, they are not looking to switch their identity from white to Native American, unlike Circe Sturm's informants, who very clearly want to eschew a white identity and become Native American. So there were different kinds of whiteness at play in my listserv versus her community. And so that was really interesting to me, to come to understand the more deeply the politics of whiteness, which I could not have done having not been in conversation with my friend, but that was many years after. The other thing that was really interesting was the double standard that existed on that listserv. And it's not just on that listserv. This double standard exists in academic science. I don't want to just pick on the listserv people. I view them very much as scientific subjects or as scientific people. They spend a tremendous amount of time. A lot of the genetic genealogists, they stay up on the science. They are in conversation with scientists and with companies. They know their stuff, some of the central figures. And I learned a lot from them. So they very much embrace the scientific subjectivity, but like the scientists that they ally themselves with, they are total chauvinists about other forms of knowledge. They think that genome knowledge is the central truth, that natural science, particularly natural science, has the universal eye on the world and has the right to narrate the world and is, at the end of the day, the foundation upon which we should base all of our decisions. And so they... they view, and while they have very complex scientific languages, and I argue in the book, we need complex languages to talk about complex things. And then our challenge is how to figure out to explain that complexity to people who don't have our training. But I am very much not a critic of the fact that complex languages emerge out of complex thinking. But they were totally willing to accommodate that in science. And they spent all of their time, many of them, they're retired, all day online, all day reading scientific articles, and totally willing to accommodate the complexity in genomics. But then if you go out into Indian country, and there's or off into the humanities side of the academy, where you've got other kinds of complex languages of specialization. We've got social theory in the academy, things like gene fetishism. There was this assumption that we were just trying to obfuscate. We just use jargon. I can't stand that word jargon. That word jargon demeans specialty language. And so who really, a geneticist is, or somebody who's enamored of genome knowledge, is going to tell me as a cultural studies person, I use jargon? I wade through all their jargon every day. I don't call it jargon. I call it specialized language. It's such a double standard. That drove me crazy. But it's not just the genetic genealogists. The scientists all around me do that all the time.
Thank you. Another one of the issues, I won't ask you to talk too much about it, but I just want to mention it for listeners, that came out of that chapter that was really interesting, is that you're considering at one point DNA as property and talking about it in terms of a natural resource. And this is actually really interesting because this speaks to large... Actually, I will ask you to talk about this. It speaks to some of the larger points that you're making elsewhere in the book, where you raise issues of colonialism, and colonialism not just of, you know, land-related colonialism, but colonialisms that emerge out of this issue, and thinking of DNA as a kind of natural resource really complicates how we think of what colonialisms are and where they are and how they are and what kind of work that they do. Was that something that was on your sort of consciously on your mind as part of the argument you were making in the book, or either way, can you speak to that a little bit?
Right. No, that's one of the things I began to think about more after the dissertation was finished, and a lot of that networking and collaborative work I was doing post graduate school. So my colleague, Jenny Reardon, and she and I wrote an article in Current Anthropology that was published in 2012 that talks a little bit about this. Jenny is head of the Science and Justice Training Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, a wonderful graduate training program, right? I love that program, so I always want to plug what they're doing. But Jenny and I have been in conversation about this. So I want to give some credit to her for we have really, I think, cross-fertilized each other's thinking. One of the things that became clear to me post-dissertation as I looked at the way that we looked at the way that Native American genomes were being talked about, it's easy for us from the vantage point of 2014 to say, well, we've made progress. You know, we would not conduct the kind of unethical research that happened even 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. We understand more now. But one of the things I like to show is that, like in the 19th century or earlier, when Native American land and other natural resources were being extracted by the colonial state in order to develop the U.S. nation, in the same way, there's a very similar rhetoric around the extraction of Native American genomes now, but it's harder for us to see this as a colonial appropriation because we feel like we've made progress. Well, we're no longer out having Indian wars and killing people and rounding them up and putting them in concentration camps, as happened with my people in after a war in 1862. So we had all of these terrible, atrocious things, but that all happened in the 19th century. We don't do that anymore. But if you look at the broader narrative, the broader ideas that structure the relationship of those in power to Native American bodies or natural resources, that broader narrative is actually quite consistent over time. And that is the idea that Native Americans are not producing anything of value, or they're not as able to produce things of value. Therefore, the state or those who are actors on behalf of the state should extract those resources in order to develop them as things of value for quote unquote the greater good. And you see this in the justifications of certain scientists who've been called to task on this. Well, you know, we're doing this, we're doing this research for the greater good. You know, maybe there's no biomedical outcomes for you. So this is a standard line, actually. I think in informed consent forms and in justifications for doing research on Native American bodies, well, we're going to do diabetes research or research on heart disease or Native American migrations research. And no, there's no immediate benefit to you, but the benefit is, you know, for the greater good of knowledge production and the greater good of all. Well, that was the example given as well in the 19th century for cordoning off Native Americans onto reservations, taking all their land and all of their resources, because the greater good at that time was the United States. There's also this way in which scientific rhetoric now is not so different from the rhetoric of manifest destiny in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And manifest destiny was more of a religious and political doctrine, but you have at the time this notion of manifest destiny being this divine right of the U.S. to move west, to conquer the land, to hold dominion over it, that it was this God-given right, that the U.S. was this civilized nation. It was bringing light to where darkness had been before. There's a classic painting of manifest destiny that shows the light in the east where the Americans are coming from, and they're moving west and the Indians are running away, and there's darkness in the west. You've got plows and farmers and trains moving west, and so light moving across the continent. Scientific rhetoric gets taken up in the same way. And so we're in the 19th century, those who were savage were viewed as unchristian and they were unenlightened. Today, those who are viewed as unenlightened are viewed as being critical of science. And so science stands in the place where religion used to stand in the 19th century. And so when I think about the potential disagreements between Native Americans around genome science and scientists, I actually put scientists over on the same side of the fence as creationists, because to me, they're operating within a broader narrative, which is that they are the light and the way. And those of us who disagree with them are just backwards.
That's really fascinating. And it really engages, I think, with a literature that's being produced right now that's a little, you know, a broader literature that looks at the language of the frontier language and the production of technoscience. And so this really speaks to that in a super fascinating way. Thank you for talking about that.
You're welcome.
And so not unrelated is what's happening in the fourth chapter. Chapter four looks closely at something called the Genographic Project. Now, rather than my summing this up, for listeners who aren't familiar with this project, could you just take a little bit of time and introduce it? What is this project? What's going on? And then this will lead us to the really interesting analysis that you give of some of the products coming out of this project later on in the chapter.
Well, so I spent many years thinking about Genographic, and I haven't been checking in with their progress on their project in the last year or so, but it was launched in 2005 by the National Geographic Society, and the person at the helm of the project, the principal investigator, is Spencer Wells, who's quite a celebrity scientist. He also works closely with Tad Shore, who I believe is at Penn. And then they have scientists all over the world at different universities who are doing some of the research and analysis in different countries. Genographic set out to sample, I think, 100,000 indigenous and traditional people around the world back when they launched in 2005. I have no idea how much progress they've made towards accumulating that many samples. That is, if anybody has tried to sample indigenous communities for human genome diversity research, they know that's a very ambitious goal they set for themselves. At the same time, they were in part funding this work by selling DNA tests online. And so I think the mitochondrial DNA test is one of the main one they were using that they were selling, I think, for $99. And so they had tremendous public participation as well, and a lot of online kind of participation around those test results, as many other companies have since come to do. So it's in part a commercial project, I think of it as a PR project for the kind of work that the kind of representational work National Geographic always does, and then in part a research project.
Right. Now, one of the many really productive kinds of work that the chapter does is it critiques, it takes apart and it complicates and looks directly at five problematic narratives, as you put it, at the intersection of race and science that the project is not just keeping alive, but it's really kind of propagating. So these five problematic narratives, I'll just mention some of them and I'll ask you to talk about a couple of them. So the first narrative, we are all African. Second, genetic science can end racism. Third, indigenous peoples are vanishing. And four, we are all related. And so we can talk about any of those that you'd like, but I'd like to zero in on the fifth one that you bring out, because this is really where one of the most interesting examples that you explore in the chapter emerges, or it's from this fifth problematic narrative. And so this problematic narrative is that the National Geographic collaborates with Indigenous peoples. And so in exploring, what does this mean to say that the National Geographic collaborates with Indigenous peoples? You're really opening up here. What does collaboration mean? Who is being collaborated with? How is collaboration? Who are Indigenous peoples? Where are they? How are they? Who gets to be representative? And how does this all play out in the public literature and the public performance of National Geographic? So can you speak to this last issue, and in particular, in the context of this video, this 30-minute video that you talk about, that features Genographic's Indigenous representatives, quote, in this chapter.
Right. And I don't think the video is any longer available. I tried to get a copy of it and could not, but luckily I transcribed it back in 2005, the whole thing. The video was really interesting. They had their three Indigenous representatives. But representatives, that's a loaded word, right? We have to think about who chooses representatives, how are they elected or appointed. These are really three men who Spencer Wells ran into in the course of either, I think, doing field work or doing other films. People who are Indigenous people, one Navajo or Diné, one, I can't remember, Hadza, I think is his group in And I'm sorry, my African geography is terrible. So in Africa, I don't work there. And then a man from Mongolia, I think is how he identifies. Is that right?
The guy with the Genghis Khan t-shirt?
Yeah. I'm not a geographer. So if I've said anything offensive in terms of geography, I'm very sorry. So yeah, that's not representation, right? I mean, that's bringing in contacts and voices. Collaboration is something that doesn't just mean having a conversation over tea or coffee with somebody in a community. It means something much more complex, and we are actually seeing a move towards strong moves towards collaboration among some genome researchers. And these are incredibly complex relationships that get developed over time that involve not just talking to people, but actually having your research project, the questions you ask, the methods you use, shaped seriously by the Indigenous people or other communities that you're in conversation with. Because scientists might have their questions that are really interesting that they're curious about, but these might not be questions that the community the bodies upon which research is being done, they might not share those same questions or priorities. And so engaging in real collaboration takes a tremendous amount of time and complex organization. And there are genome scientists who do that. I would not say that that's really what Genographic is doing. I think they talk to people, I think, but the degree to which their research is truly informed by the priorities of Indigenous people, I think that is not the case. I also think collaboration involves real capacity building of the communities that you're working with. So are you building their capacity to engage in research, to review your research? We need a lot of capacity building in Indigenous communities if we're going to engage with genome research. We don't just have the institutions and structures and people with forms of education to do this. The other thing I like to talk about is, you know, there's, if you really look at the benefits that accrue to scientists from doing this work, they are career benefits. They get jobs, they're building their institutions, they're building their laboratories, they're training their graduate students, and Indigenous peoples are supposed to just take as a benefit, the good of humanity, or maybe in the long term, very, very long term, there might be some biomedical benefit to something, but you probably personally won't benefit. Meanwhile, you've got all of these economic and prestige benefits accruing to scientists. And I think if you're really talking about collaboration, let's talk about the development of Indigenous community institutions. Let's talk about the training of Indigenous people. Let's talk about the building of Indigenous economies, not just the U.S. economy or Western economies, based on genome research. And even in President Obama's, one of his inauguration speeches, he talks explicitly about genome research as a national economic development platform. States all over the world are getting in on this game, and indigenous people, like in the 19th century, are supposed to just hand over our resources for other people to develop as they will for the good of their institutions and economies, and we're just supposed to take you're doing it for the good of humanity. Mm-hmm. That's not collaboration.
And in fact, this actually really nicely brings us to the last chapter, the conclusion, because in the conclusion, you take this and you explore, right, what are some of the ways to think about doing this? What are some of the ways to think about and to actually put into practice creating a more productive engagement and a more sort of co-creation oriented engagement between genetic science and Native peoples in the future? So you take us through some of the ways that you're suggesting that it's not only possible to, but in some ways people are starting to already do this, to create a research environment, right, where Indigenous peoples are agents of knowledge production and are co-producing knowledge. So can you talk specifically about some of the ways that you think either we should be, we can be doing that practically as a way forward, and or ways that some of the institutions you're talking about here are starting to do that? What does it mean, and what is it practically, and what should it practically look like in the future to involve Indigenous peoples in conceiving and creating the research questions that are motivating the development of genetic science?
Well, I mean, the first thing I want to say is that I also think it's legitimate to resist and to build our capacity to resist effectively. I mean, doing research, any kind of research, whether it's genome research or some other kind of Western academic research, takes tremendous time and energy and learning. And when you invest your energy and time and your human resource capacity in those projects, you're not investing them elsewhere. So I really think that, but that said, one of the main avenues for tribes and other Indigenous people to expand their sovereignty, especially in an era where we've got a very conservative Supreme Court, where you've got courts ruling against tribal rights that have been negotiated as part of a government-to-government relationship. I mean, as you probably know, most our treaties have not been upheld. They've been violated by the U.S. You know, we are at the mercy of U.S. courts that are that are engendered of these long racist colonial histories. So I always argue that one of the ways that tribes can actually expand their governance authority is by engaging more with science and technology and building those kinds of institutions. Because if you want to have a place at any policymaking table, you know, in any state, you've got to engage with a scientific language. And so that's one way for us to do that. And I think that in part, we need to not just be training so many Native American attorneys, and we have many, because the battle line for us has been in the courts. But I think increasingly the battle line is moving out into scientific languages and fields. All decisions supposedly get informed by science, whether that's policy science or natural science. And we need people who can sit at those tables and engage in those conversations. And even I think if you're going to resist effectively, I think you need to take part in that. And so I advocate, in addition to collaborative research, and I'm really interested in working with scientists who really want to work in that way, who realize that the world has changed and they're going to, slow down their work and work more collaboratively. I like to work with them and advocate for the work that they're doing. But I also think we need to focus on training more Indigenous scientists as well, and people who can participate in those conversations around science and ethics, who can maybe start doing science in different kinds of ways. And my next project is about that too. I'm interviewing and doing participant observation with Native American and other Indigenous bioscientists, and looking at the ways that they might begin to ask different kinds of questions and work in different ways. But I may not be answering your question fully.
That actually, that you're already getting to one of the questions that I wanted to ask you from this, which was, I'm just totally fascinated to hear about your next project, and this comes organically out of what you were talking about.
Right.
So also, this speaks to not just one of the questions I was going to ask you later, right, which is what you're working on next, but also it speaks directly to the issues that you're bringing up in this very practice-oriented conclusion. Can you share at all, or what are some of, or maybe one or two of the concrete ways that you see indigenous epistemological frameworks, right? So this is a really strong kind of a concept informing a different kind of research question. Is there an example that you've seen that really shows here's a way that a very different kind of epistemological framework has generated a new kind of research question in this area?
Well, so I have to say many of the indigenous bioscientists I've encountered, most of them, are very young in their careers. They're either still in graduate school or they're postdocs. And you cannot assume because they're indigenous that they are going to have a complex sense of politics and how to really change things. I mean, anybody in science knows how, you know, much your progress is based on the doors that are open for you by your advisors, by people in places of power over you, how expensive it is to get a lab up and running. And then we're facing increased funding cuts and there's people just dropping out of science, right? Because they can't, it's a very expensive enterprise. Not like social science is a lot cheaper. So it's hard enough culturally, I think, for indigenous peoples to go into science, to stay in science. And then even once they get there, and if they have a success, it's hard to stay over the long term. So we don't have many people who are in very high up positions yet who have actually been able to make real changes in the field. What I see, though, is potential. But I have to say that potential also relies on politicizing indigenous scientists. They are not any more naturally politicized than non-indigenous scientists are. That was one thing I was kind of dismayed to find in my research, because I think I grew up in the under the cultural influence of the American Indian Movement. I was born in 1968. That was an incredibly political time for many people in this country. I grew up with an inherent and obvious sense of politics and a sense the young people I meet today. Not to sound like an old fogey, but they didn't come out of the same era that I came out of. And so I was mistaken in thinking all these other Native American intellectuals were going to have my same sense of politics. Well, they don't if they were born in 1980. It's different, you know, or 1990. So that's partly why I get involved in this, in mentoring and being colleagues with young Native American scientists, because I feel that the work that I do has something to offer them. That said, though, being Native American. And the other thing I found is a lot of the Native scientists that I've interviewed, and I did not expect this, they tend to be from tribal land bases. And I haven't quite figured that out. My guess is, and I need to find a way to figure this out in my subsequent interview questions, my guess is that because they grew up in rural areas on tribal lands, maybe they were more in contact with animals and the land and got interested in cells and things like that, or in the materiality of things. Whereas if you look at the Native American social scientists and humanities people I know who are, for example, in Native American and Indigenous studies, I would say a much larger proportion of us are diaspora. Indigenous people, so people who didn't grow up primarily on tribal lands and have geared towards the humanities. So this is very interesting to me. But because these young Native scientists, many of them have grown up on or near tribal lands, they have really interesting questions, material-like questions. So I'll give you one example of a different way that a question might get asked by somebody based on being Native American and thinking about questions from out of this land base and out of this history that's not so much informed by immigration history. I know one young scientist who works on corn genomics and is really interested in the way that you can look at the relationships of different strains of corn and how that might help us track the movements and relationships of different indigenous peoples in the Americas. And so he's really looking at corn and humans as being relations. And this is something we talk about in our communities, that we have human, non-human relations. We don't have, in a lot of indigenous people don't tend to have in their own cosmologies, this human-animal split and hierarchy in the same way that happens in both Christianity and then Western scientific cosmologies. So he's looking at corn-human relations. You know, how, and that implies that corn is an agent. It implies it's a being with its own life path, and it can push back and affect Native American and tribal lives. And so I thought that was really interesting. You know, I've also seen Native American genetic scientists who are not so much interested in the migration of humans across the Bering Strait and other parts of the world, but again, the movements within the Americas. How are we related to other people? And again, that is to center the Americas. It's to center this part of the world, which is the center of the world in our cosmology. And so I think the kinds of questions they will ask, if they can get to a place where they are not so indoctrinated by dominant narratives might really be quite interesting, because it's possible for young academics to be indoctrinated by a dominant narrative. And it's also possible that they come from a tribal community where they have the resources to deconstruct that and do something different if they want.
So that is completely fascinating. And I think that's a really good place to bring this to a close. And I will just say, I can't wait to talk with you about that book, and I can't wait to read that book when that's done. So Kim, I've already taken up a lot of your time, but I just want to ask, is there anything that we didn't have a chance to talk about? And there's a ton of material in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's extraordinarily rich, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book.
Well, I tried to make the book fairly accessible, but you know, when you're an academic, you lose sight maybe of what accessible means for non-academics. And so I've heard it both ways. I've heard my mom said to me, "Oh, honey, I understood the whole thing." And that's the audience I wanted. Somebody, my mom's an educated, smart woman. She's not formally educated, but she's an intellectual. And I'd like to target that kind of audience, not just academics, but people out there who are thinking people, who are really interested in issues. But then I also saw a review in a science magazine that said I was using jargon. So I don't know if it's accessible or not. I hope so. And I tried to write it in a way that will reach multiple audiences.
Well, Kim, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book, and best of luck on the new project. That sounds fascinating as well. And most of all, thank you.
Oh, thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.